So we started doing multiple kind of experiments right out of during our college years itself. Once something worked, something didn't. Then we kind of eventually ended up launching in Shorts as a Facebook page on 1st of April, 2013, with the pretext that in case this goes wrong, then we'll just explain it away by saying that's an April Fool's joke. Or in fact, Play Store, even today, there is no application that goes undownloaded. Right? If you put any application, whatever it is, on the Play Store, you are definitely going to get some downloads. Okay? Like, Play Store has that power, immense power.
Welcome to the Indian Silicon Valley podcast. I'm your host, Jivraj, and today I have with me a very exciting guest. Join me in welcoming Deepit Purkhast, the co-founder of InShorts Group. Thank you so much, Deepit, for joining me. Very excited to be hosting you.
Thanks, Jivraj, for having me over. It's really exciting to see so much Silicon Valley-ish activity in India. And happy to be on the podcast, which is called the namesake, the Indian Silicon Valley podcast. So happy to be here.
Glad to hear that. And I think so much of the name gets personified by the work that you're doing. Because in India, building a social play has always traditionally been very difficult. But I think you and group have been at it for a considerably long time. And I think I want to take this opportunity to decode much of it. As we get started, I probably want to outline that through the next 60 odd minutes, right? What we can cover is, how do you go about building social in India? How do you, as a group, you know, you've built these multiple plays now. You've also built it out in a very, very thoughtful, fundamental manner. And considering that you've been graduates just out of college when you started, I want to understand that mindset. And then we'll understand the team dynamics. To get us started, maybe it is always good to go down memory lane. You took a gap year precisely, right, to get started and experiment with something that could be decently questionable at the time. And when starting up or dropping out or taking a gap year, none of it was cool. Talk to us about how that unfolded, what are memories like of that time, and how you got started in this journey.
Absolutely. It's crazy to think about it, but it's actually been just a little over 10 years since our first days in this journey. Me and my co-founder Azhar and Anunay, we were three founders. And Azhar and I go back to school and we did our coaching together. And from right after we entered our kind of campuses, he was in IIT Delhi, I was in IIT Kharagpur. We used to constantly talk to each other about, so he was studying computing, I was studying computer science. So we were all studying similar stuff, algorithms, and we were seeing the application side of what we were studying as well in the form of software products that were coming on the internet. For example, internet applications like Facebook had just like completely disrupted the Orkut use cases at that time. And we were very, very amazed to see what was happening in the internet space. And we thought that given that we are studying, we have the right skill set to kind of attempt something like that from India as well. We were like naive and ambitious, and being naive and ambitious helps you that way. So we started doing multiple kind of experiments right out of during our college years itself. Once something worked, something didn't. Then we kind of eventually ended up launching In Shorts as a Facebook page on 1st of April, 2013, with the pretext that in case this goes wrong, then we'll just explain it away by saying that's an April Fool's joke. But fortunately for us, it didn't happen. We got immense feedback. And so that's how all of this started, right? So the core idea was that there are that information consumption on the internet was that it had some very unique nuances when it came to the Indian customers or the Indian users. And we thought that all innovation that is happening in the Silicon Valley and then coming to India probably is not the way how the next generation of consumer tech products for India will be built. And that is where we kind of thought that we are going to stay in this smaller domain of information on the internet and try to innovate products that are built on deep insights about Indian consumers or the Indian customers and how they consume the internet. And that's how we started In Shorts, right? So the consumer insight that got us there was basically that people in our peer group were not reading news, right? And platforms at the time online were just dumping whatever they had in their offline kind of medium, whether they were TVs, TV channels or newspapers, they were just dumping their content online in a very cluttered way. So they were not building for the internet. And that's how InShorts was born. When we started this, I think right into the journey within first 2-3 months, and also because of our previous projects experiences, we realized that the only way to build a company is building full time, right? And you need to, at least in the first few years, you need to do it completely full time. There is no other way around. And sometimes experienced folks who have a lot of experience can manage doing it part time for some time. But for us, who were people who had no idea about how to build a venture, they had never worked in workspaces. Like, the only places we worked were our internships at different organizations. So the only way it was to do it full time. And thankfully, we had a leverage that we could use to convince our parents for that 1 year gap. Mm. And it was basically having a check from Times Internet's T Labs Accelerator program. It was a small check, just 10 lakh rupees at that point of time. But it meant a lot to us to showcase to our parents that, see, we have validation from one of the largest media internet companies in India, right? Yeah. That they are endorsing that this is something that you is worth investing in. So it's definitely worth our time. So that's how we started.
Nice. Now, a lot of interesting nuances there. Can you double click on those insights, right? Also, on the maturity that you exhibited at the time, because I feel that currently, you know, it's easy to say things like, okay, information deficit, too much, building it out in, you know, an interesting format, will social work or not? But at the time, I'm guessing you didn't have as many data points. So was the research very thorough, or was it more intuition based? What was the groundwork that you did to get to the conclusion that this is going to be the shape and form that we go ahead with?
Yeah, and it's a very interesting thing. I think this theme will kind of reemerge in our conversation multiple times in everything that we have done so far, which is, so before launching InShorts, there was a year completely before that where we were working on a project where we actually built the platform or the product for almost 9 out of the 12 months. And we also went into market after that and probably did consumer conversations twice, right? Today, it's very widely available advice, especially because of startup school and things like that, that first 10 weeks, you should be speaking to 100 customers or 50 customers or whatever. But we learned it the hard way. Hmm. And when we went into market, we realized what we were building was very cool, but nobody needed it.
Right.
The market was behind that. So that kind of shaped our intuition about our next project, which was InShorts, that we are not going to build anything that people don't need. Mm-hmm. And perhaps that shaped the reason why we launched a Facebook page, which seems like, why would a Facebook page be an MVP? But it worked for us. At that time, every person who was on the internet and spending any sizable amount of time who would be our potential audience was already on Facebook, right? Their time was not divided across 5 platforms. It was completely available on Facebook most of the time. So it was a great place to do an MVP, right? And fundamentally, the value that we were trying to drive through InShorts as a platform is a content value, right? Which is that you will get short news summaries, right? That can easily be kind of added to the person's life through a Facebook page as well. So it was a great MVP. And that shaped us our entire journey. We love hacky, simple MVPs.
Nice.
And like something that can be done within 2 weeks. And in fact, that is something that my co-founder Azhar holds very dearly to him. He doesn't want to do anything that cannot be tested in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So I think that is a great DNA to have because the interesting part of consumer internet that I can say right now after being in the space for 10 years is that the hit rates are really low.
Yeah.
Either you do something that is very good and it's kind of a sixer, right?
Yeah.
Or it's a completely, like, you don't score anything, right?
Mm.
So the way to maximize returns that we have realized over time is to do more experiments.
Iterate.
Yeah,
mm.
Increase your throughput of experiments.
Correct.
And that's what somehow intuitively we arrived at by spending 1 year and going nowhere with our previous project.
Got it. I think this is build fast, ship fast, you know, personified as it comes. And very interesting to know the specific examples, because I think otherwise it's so fancy to think you get the right product out, but there is no right. The consumer decides it. You get more iterations. Awesome. I think that'll be one definitive takeaway from this conversation. Coming to more specifics of social now, maybe, right? Can you maybe take us through the journey and help us understand at what point were there light bulb moments, which is to say that, okay, this clicked, this version clicked, this is what we're going to do ahead. What are these levers that helped you establish and grow in shots at scale? Because this feels like a problem where there can be strong adoption, but to get enough critical mass always remains a problem. And that's where things like network effects, growth loops comes into the picture. So what was the initial thought process around it, and what were growth levers that you apply to get to the mass that you have now?
Yeah, and this has been a very kind of iterative journey for us. Because the pro of having a very quick, dirty MVP mindset is that you can test things fast. But the cons is that the insight that you kind of leverage, it has a shelf life. It has a cap as to till what scale can this insight be leveraged to get to a certain certain point in your growth journey, right? For example, the Facebook page thing, first 3 weeks, there was immense growth. We got 3,000, 4,000 likes very fast. And then it plateaued, right? So we realized Facebook page is not the way to go, right? That time, we didn't even know we are going to build an app, truly speaking. So from that point, we built a website. We were interacting with our customers. One of the customers or users at that point of time, or followers, so like to be very, very frank, on the Facebook page, said, why are you not building an Android app, right? And he was a junior of mine, and he was learning Android development as a passion project, and somehow he had an Android phone with him, and he was probably that 1% of our entire hostel who had an Android smartphone at that point of time, right? All of us were on Nokia 1100s. So we thought, it seems interesting. Why don't we pool in some money, get one basic Android smartphone, and let's build an app on it. Our co-founder Anunay, he was in Delhi with Azhar, and we started building the first kind of product around this. And I also kind of, this was in, I think, April-ish when I had ended my semester, and we came to, we were working out of Delhi, and we launched our first Android application. Interestingly, what happened was, when we launched our first Android application, the first data that we started seeing was the power of repeat usage. Somehow, Play Store at that point of time, or in fact, Play Store even today, there is no application that goes undownloaded, right? If you put any application, whatever it is, on the Play Store, you are definitely going to get some downloads, okay? Like, Play Store has that power, immense power, to get you at least some trial adoption. And what we realized was, before even we put the message out on the on our kind of social media handles that this is the app we've launched,
downloaded.
We already had some bit of downloads, and there was constant repeat usage, right? Whoever was coming, it was five users, but those five users were coming every day after that. And that was very, very powerful for us to feel. We didn't know anything like what are the smile curves or what are the retention metrics that should be aspired for. But intuitively, we felt that repeat usage is what we need to go after. And then kind of we, at that point of time, the app looked like the very old BlackBerry mail boxes. So it had a headline, it had a summary, it was completely grayscale, and all colors were just versions of gray. And then there were two arrow buttons to go to the previous content or the next content. And once you are done, you'll just get a prompt saying you're done for the day. So there was just 10 shots on the platform. And people, I don't know what was magical about it, but people loved the done for the day, right? that the sense of completion, that, okay, this is all I needed to know. So compare that experience from the previous experience of going to, say, a digital website, seeing tons of links, not knowing which one to pick, right? Which is what is important, what is not, and feeling that even if someone is a repeat user of a news website, feeling that I'm not adequate. Whatever I'm doing is not adequate to build my knowledge or my current affairs kind of updatedness. And compare it to the offline mode where you would skip through long pages. Yeah. It's still such a differentiated value addition that could only happen on a smartphone, right? Let alone the value addition of a smartphone allowing consumption on the go, right? So those are the levers that hadn't started playing out. But I think that initial lever of launching an app and apps fundamentally being different from websites in the sense that they can give you repeat usage because it stays on the phone and you can also send notifications was the big first lever that started working for us. That took us to a differentiated scale.
Awesome. That was lovely to understand, and especially the nuances around the versions that you've launched, right? They say if you're not ashamed of your first version that you shipped, you've probably not shipped it out early enough. And that was very nice to note. But as we go further, right, I want to double click on the form factor. And because I've heard of the specific insight that you have around how we think in our native languages, but the English bit is what we are trained to understand in short form, right? Maybe if you can double click on why this summary bit is something that you fundamentally boil down to and how the app currently looks, and that'll be very helpful.
Yes, absolutely. And I think you are absolutely right. I think if it were up to us, for example, if you and me were speaking outside of this podcast, we would probably be speaking in some version of English and not just English. But somehow, because of our schooling system, especially there's and the aspirational kind of quality of being trained in speaking and writing and reading in English, all majority of the country's educated population actually is much more comfortable reading in English but talking in Hindi, right? And that's what most of the school culture is also, right? When you are writing exams, you are talking in English, but when you are like whispering with your benchmate, you would be talking in Hindi, right? So it's true for most schools in India, except for probably the most that's a differentiated audience completely. So I would say that that was a very, very critical insight, that fundamentally why would people consume text online in English was a reason, because people are aspirationally trained towards that.
Correct.
And we think that that population is going to keep, like, it is going to incrementally only increase every year in India, because even though there is no there is more widely kind of we are like as a society we are evangelizing Indic languages and probably more training and learning in Indic languages, to be a connected economy globally, we will still need this skills of being in English. And because we are a services driven economy, right? We are not a production driven economy or manufacturing driven economy where you don't have to interact so much, right? We are a completely services driven economy. So it will always be important for us as a country. So I think all these layers make it's a very high potential kind of use case, that consuming text and especially short text in English in India, right? Because people in general in India are also not book readers, right? Most people in India don't read books, right? And even in Indic languages, people don't read books. So people are not in the habit of reading a lot. People are in the habit of watching a lot or listening a lot. But even in the olden days, people who used to read was much smaller versus people used to just switch on the radio and keep on the site, right? So, and that's how the various communication revolutions happened in India. So I think all of this kind of points to the same fact that when people are reading online, they want to read something crisp and very, very quickly.
Absolutely. No, this is very fascinating. I think these insights on a very deep level make for a lot of interesting observations. I'd be curious to know, I think a large part of what you've initially said is also how do you condense insights, right? This process in itself feels like a very fascinating thing. Do you have any learnings broadly on how to collect insights, iterate on top, and then deliver value, agnostic of, let's say, InShots?
I don't know. I can't claim to have anything differentiated. I try to learn personally from whatever is out there on the internet. But I think one thing that generally helps is people talk a lot about data. Mm-hmm. But what they don't understand about data is that you could look at data with a confirmation bias and it'll end up showing you or confirming your biases, right? Mm-hmm. So the art of using data for your shaping your perception about what product decisions to take, what business decisions to take, is mostly about staying very, very brutally honest to yourself and not using data as a crutch to whatever is your bias and whatever you're trying to advocate for. Okay. If you had a bias, obviously everybody has predispositions, but if you process data in a very, very neutral way and you come to an evidence of something that is kind of a contradiction to what you believed, yeah, you should be the first one to acknowledge it. And that's the only way you can convince everybody around you to also be very data driven, because then they will trust the process and not that, okay, data is just used to, then everybody will try to shape narratives around their biases using data, and that becomes a very bad culture.
Got it. Interesting. So intellectual honesty and data is the way to go when it comes to insights. Great. I think we covered an interesting bit. Coming to the bit around monetization, right? I think this is oversaid, overdone, to be like, it is very difficult to monetize Indian social, right? I mean, if I had to put that blanket statement out there and understand what you have done differently, because InShots has, of course, proven that hypothesis wrong. And there's so much else to be done. So from your macro and micro observations of building InShots, what do you think about that? And why is the general perception broken around this?
Yeah, so I think there are lots of very influential entrepreneurs and VCs in the ecosystem who have started putting out material for public consumption via their Twitter channels or things like that. Nikhil Kamat, for example, puts out a lot of things. That Indian audiences, where the money is not a 1 billion audience. It's probably the top 50 million audience at max. Yeah. And probably even if you do a 80-20 cut of that 50 million, then you will see that 80% of the value creation or economy is being driven by probably the top 10 million, right? So that is a very, very interesting thing. And there we got lucky. We didn't optimize for it, but we got lucky in the way that because we were doing short form news on content in for people, what ended up happening was people who were time starved ended up gravitating to this platform. And just to think about the kind of people who are time starved are people who are generally putting their time to good use, right? And if they're putting their time to good use, they will be somewhere in the much higher in the kind of economic value chain, right? So our audience ended up being very, very premium on InShots. So 70% of our users had a smartphone above 10,000 rupees probably 6 years back, and currently 70% would have a smartphone above 15,000 rupees. So we have always stayed ahead of the curve in terms of providing, being an option for the advertiser to be the most premium destination or the most premium vehicle to get attention of your audience, of the audience that you're trying to target. The second thing that we did really, really right was not plugging our inventory to ad exchanges. The reason why it worked for us, it is not something that can work for everybody, but the reason why it worked for us was because of the premiumness of our inventory. If we would have exposed it to, say, ad networks or ad exchanges, there would be commoditization of that inventory. And because of that, we would get a certain premium above the baseline trading rates of, say, whatever is the baseline ECPM rates, we would get a certain premium, but it would not be a big multiple. So probably if we keep this inventory exclusive and then directly go to brands and curate the right form factors of ads and different kinds of innovations on ads for our platform, we would be able to drive a lot of multiple on the baseline ECPM rates. And that's what we did really, really well.
Got it.
For example, there is a unique format that works on our platform, which gets a sizable amount of revenue, which is our sponsored stories, right? Yeah. Which look exactly like the InShorts card. And then there is a disclaimer at the end. It says powered by so-and-so. And there also, we to maintain trust with the audience, we never make, we make sure that the brand is aligned, that we will never make endorse statements by the brand that say that this brand is the best, right? You can say that this brand is has this features. Because that is a brand, that is the brand is a custodian of saying what their features are, but they can't say something non-factual as that they are the best, right?
It can't be a direct endorsement. It can be a qualitative assessment.
Okay. And in fact, this inventory is we are the only ones that sell it in the market, and the brand uplift that we get out of, or the brand recall that we get out of a summary, is higher than any full screen ad that gets sold in the market, right? Because you have actually communicated to your potential audience that these are my features, these are my specs. Now, if you want to buy this, you can buy this. And it's so general, there is no blindness that has developed in our audience for this type of content. They're still processing that 60 words that they are receiving about the brand.
Got it. Perfect. I think that's very exciting. In fact, before going deeper into monetization, why don't we take a step back and just talk about the plain business model? If I had to ask you, what is the business model of InShorts? What would you have to say?
Yeah, so the business model of InShorts is it's a free application for users to download and consume. It's available on Android and iOS. And our revenue model is primarily advertising. And within advertising also, it's primarily direct selling. We are not into programmatic kind of ad revenue at all. And the reason is because we have a very premium exclusive audience for the brands, which this kind of an audience is not available at scale in anywhere, in any platform in India.
Got it. Perfect. Yeah. I think that just like helps baseline clearance.
Yes.
To begin, and also like maybe taking another step back, in terms of curation of the articles that are on board, right? What is the level of control that a platform exhibits to ensure that this is highly qualitative, yet not highly subjective to the platform? What are the kind of controls that you've taken on that front? Post this, we can double click on this monetization bit.
Yeah. So I think on the platform side, we made a conscious call that there will be a lot of a platform like our news platform like ours will always have the signals which are trending signals, which can create echo chambers for the consumer. And at the same time, there are important signals, which irrespective of consumer behavior, based on some other signals, you can understand that this kind of content is important, irrespective of whether the customer actually consuming it or not. So we made a conscious choice of training our algorithms on keeping a balance between both of these signals. Now, someone could argue that, it's slightly more balanced towards trending stuff. It's not as much balanced towards important stuff. But that definition of that balance will be very, very subjective, right? It can be, it'll be a different answer for every person we speak to. We try to take an informed call, some data-driven call around that balance. We keep auditing this every year, every few months sometimes, to check that if things are going well, are people satisfied? Are serious news readers also satisfied? Are casual news readers also satisfied? And kind of take both groups along. As we kind of build this further.
Got it. But just to be clear, on the moderation front, is there control from the platform exercised on each piece of news that an audience sees, or is it very democratic in nature? And so, what are controls built on that front?
So it's completely algorithmic. Whatever it is, it's algorithmic. At the same time, we do have some qualitative signals that we capture based on certain kinds of audience feedback. For example, when sending out notifications, right? There is a test notification that probably goes out to certain groups of users. And then there is some comparison done. There is some models around that. And before it gets kind of scaled up to the larger audiences. So there are these kind of automated moderation that is happening at every level.
Fair enough. No, very interesting to know. I think that clarifies a bunch of things. I'm sure there's a lot of data usage, and I'll come to that in a minute. But talking about monetization again, right? Since this is direct selling to brands, I'm guessing this requires a very interesting DNA within the company as well. Maybe talk to us about what that means. And also, what are the kind of companies maybe, like on a broad basis? Are these mostly international giants who want to cater to this specific consumer set? Or are these Indian companies as well, right? Because there's a lot of, again, debate around, okay, do Indian companies spend a lot on advertising? Do they drive enough ROI? All of that. How do you look at that spectrum, and what have learnings been on the advertising spend in the country from the InShots lens?
Yeah, at a macro level, India ad spend as a function of household consumption expenditure.
Okay.
So advertising spend is a function of how much people are consuming in terms of different products and services that they are buying, right? As a percentage, when we compare different kinds of countries, India, in say the top among the top 10 economies, India would be an under-penetrated economy in terms of the total ad spend, offline, online, everything combined. So there is a huge headroom for companies to kind of advertise more. The reason why it is under-penetrated was because we as a country are shifting from a completely license-driven or a very, very controlled economy model in, say, the 1980s to a completely laissez-faire model where there will be a completely free market. So advertising fundamentally is a driver of growth, right? Yeah. It's a driver of adoption. It is a driver of protecting market share, right? Mm-hmm. And that competitive tension between brands and offerings, if that is not maintained enough, then advertising penetration will be low. But over time, I think that competitive tension has only been getting better for in all domains that we see. So having said that, that this is the kind of macro scenario. At the micro scenario, what happens for us is that since a lot of brands are actually very, very smart to know that the money is in the premium audiences, they are the actual kind of spenders who I should definitely capture. Obviously, not all brands are kind of trying to sell to this audience. For example, say a Patanjali would not be wanting to sell to this audience versus say a Surf Excel, right? So the audiences are, the brands are very, very different. But at the same time, we do have presence of large multinationals who have strong Indian businesses or Indian subsidiaries who have been in the market and completely Indianized DNA, right? Like for example, an HUL could completely be called an Indian company that way. They have been part of our life since generations, right? At the same time, say, so I think looking at this MNC versus India thing, I think it's getting a bit obsolete. In fact, more and more MNCs are Indianizing their Indian businesses because to drive larger integration with society and growth, right? So I think we have a fair share of both types of companies. I have not seen Indian companies being resistant to investing in advertising. The only thing that was there was at the macro level. At the micro level, I think it's a very, very healthy thing happening right now.
Awesome. That's lovely to know that ground reality says that, okay, Indian companies are, you know, advertising as much as their international counterparts, and there are a lot of Indianization in the MNCs as well. Interesting. Going further, right, I think as we understand monetization better, we'll come to public in a bit, because I think that's also another a very interesting lever of what the InShots group now is doing. To understand that in the 6-7 years of the initial journey, I'm sure you've seen multiple other companies try to break into somewhat of a similar spectrum, doing similar things, right? Talking about that transformation and coming up with public, right? talk to us about how much of that is very internally driven to say that, okay, we must be at the cusp of innovation. So we have to do a bunch of things, but we can't do everything, right? So how much of that is about focus versus iteration versus innovation? And how much of it is externally driven as well, because there's so much happening. I'm sure the natural inclination is we know how to crack something. Can we crack the others as well? So if that helps as a baseline foundation to understand what Public was about when you conceptualized it, and of course what it's become, that'd be very helpful.
Yeah, I think this is a kind of googly question. I feel,
yeah,
because it's something that I think entrepreneurs learn on the job, right? That when to respond to market,
yeah,
and when something should be more internally driven. I don't think there is a science to this.
Correct.
It's very, very personal. It's sometimes very whatever is the consensus. Like we are three founders, we have shareholders, we have key employees. There is a collective thinking that's happening in the company, right? Okay. And that there's intelligence in that collective thinking, right? Yeah. So I think the outcomes of it usually happen. For example, I'm trying to think back about what was that cusp when Public was launched, right?
Yeah.
So before Public, we had already started experimenting a couple of products, okay, on the vernacular side of things. The reason was the insurance business had there was a hockey stick growth that was happening. Revenue was scaling, everything was happening. But at that time, there was a large movement happening around us, which was this cheap data prices, the fall of data prices, and the large masses of Indian audiences who were being brought into the internet ambit because of Jio launch, right? So I think that was a big movement that we were not able to ride on just because of insure. Like, we were riding on it up to a certain extent, but not completely, because it was primarily a English text oriented product. So to kind of make sure that we are, since we were positioned rightly in this at that inflection point in the Indian internet landscape, what would be the approach to kind of capture this strong kind of tailwind that was being created by the giants of the industry? So that is where we started experimenting multiple products, and we realized that we also wanted to stay within the information use cases. So I think that is where we drew the balance, that what we won't venture out is information, but what we will venture out is in terms of audience. We won't stay constrained to our form factor at all,
right,
or our use case also at all, but we will stay true to our information use case, because that is something that we understand and we know how the information supply chain works, right?
Got it.
So that's where we experimented multiple products, and the Public app, as we know today, got launched. And incidentally, that also happened to be in the month of April in 2019, 6 years after InShorts was launched. Okay. So we had already launched Public in a different form factor in 4 or 5 months back. But that was not working out. And then we did a couple of iterations. The current application was something very, very simple, that the hypothesis was that India, these new Indian audiences that are coming onto the internet, a lot of them have disposable income. A lot of them have access to good smartphones, and they are probably living in towns. They are not living in cities, but they are living in towns, but they are not living in villages, right? So they are aspirationally, they have aspirations, and they are upwardly mobile. This is probably about 50% of the adult population of India. Right. So India has about these 10,000 urban centers. So India has about 800 districts. Each district has about 12 urban centers. Okay. And each urban center is basically what we know as towns and cities. So these 10,000 urban centers are towns and cities, okay, including satellite towns of big metro cities. So these urban centers have small communities around them. So each urban center has probably a community of 100,000. Okay. Ballpark. India has a population of 1.4 billion. So it's about 100,000 to 150,000 kind of a population, of which about 50% is digitized. So this 50,000 audience doesn't have a digital town square, right? Where the influencers of that community can come and communicate with this 50,000 population.
Correct.
Where these people can can follow and see what's happening in their kind of township, right? So we the core use case was, how do we build a town square for them on the internet? Mm-hmm. And how do we do it at scale, at India scale, you know? Yeah. And that's how Public was born. So we went, so the go-to market for Public was, we picked up five locations, five districts, and we went deep. We found, we mapped who are the potential content creators in these five places, mm-hmm. get them on board, and start aggressively marketing and kind of getting customer acquisition going, right? Once there is sufficient density, organic will definitely happen. So yeah. That was the hypothesis we went in. What was surprising for us was we thought that InShorts is a premium tier one product. It has a certain amount of M12 retention, D30 retention. Vernacular Indic languages, even if it is 70% of that, we will consider ourselves successful because there is a lot of churn. Mm-hmm. There are lots of kind of issues, onboarding, etc. But our retention on that product was much more than InShorts. And to have that with an Indic language product was crazy validation, right?
Yeah.
We were very, very excited. So I think the insight that we drew from that was that it's not like tier two audiences don't want information. They are not interested just in like dance videos, right? They also want information which is relevant to them. Yeah. They don't have the sophistication to understand how repo rates are going to change their lives. But they have enough sophistication to understand that if there is a crime happening, then there is a law and order issue happening and I need to hold my local community leader responsible, right? So that is the difference in approach.
Got it. No, but that's brilliant. I think this hyperlocal social as a concept, right? I don't think it's been explored as much, but InShorts has now pioneered it. Very interestingly, when it comes to the trade-off of having an existing audience, let's say with InShorts, you already have a base, right? Do you want to build for that base further? Or do you think this approach of building for another audience was more impactful? I'd love to know your thoughts there.
So there's no science to it. It's yeah. ultimately a guesstimate of numbers, right?
Yeah.
One should never leave out incremental growth mm-hmm. on their existing products
right.
because that would leave you open to disruption.
Mm-hmm.
So that needs to constantly happen. Mm-hmm. And obviously, companies get constrained right. with time, focus, etc. But they should institutionalize it enough to make sure that incrementally continues to happen. But at the same time, if you're not spotting for large opportunities, then where will those like big bursts of growth come from, right? Because as products mature, there are very few levers that can give you probably 200% year-on-year growth, right?
Correct.
So where are those opportunities for 200% year-on-year growth? And this kind of a use case where fundamentally, the internet landscape was changing with kind of data, cheap data prices, large internet adoption. That was a big wave that no one should have missed, right?
Yeah.
It would have costed them dearly if they would have yeah. missed it.
No, absolutely. Cool. I think this is very, very, very interesting. What I want to understand further is, you know, a lot of the components that you've spoken about and a chat that we had briefly before this conversation on Zoom was around, let's say, building fundamentally strong institutions, right? And that shows in the way you've been deliberate about the launches, the way in which you've built the company, be it the team, the hiring, no offsetting, right? No ongoing levers of having layoffs. Or on the capital side, utilizing capital very judiciously, building a profitable company. Talk to us about this DNA within the company and how, more importantly, as a founder, have you been able to spread it across the organization and not just have it as a ambit of thought in your head?
So we learned it the hard way, mm-hmm. To be frank. So we were, if I were to go back slightly back in our journey,
mm-hmm.
after the initial stages that we already talked about. So what happened was in 2015, we got our Series A check led by Tiger Global. And that was the period when suddenly India started seeing $4 million Series A checks. Mm-hmm. And we were the first crop of 5-6 companies who saw that. And within 6 months, we also raised our Series B, which was a $20 million check, also read by Tiger Global, right? So it was a very, being just 25-year-old, just freshly graduates from college, we didn't understand economic cycles that well, you know. We thought, okay, we took this as a sign of validation that we will get more capital if we grow further, right? And that is the time when e-commerce companies were becoming large. E-commerce was already happening, so we thought there's a lot, something will happen in content as well. In China, there were lots of tailwinds that had happened, like ByteDance was in their early days, seeing early spikes of strong growth. They had only a news application at that point of time. They hadn't launched TikTok by then. But there was very strong growth that they were seeing. So all of that, those signals made us think that, okay, we are here, right?
Yeah.
And we went into, for a few months, we went into the opposite end of whatever you described our company's DNA to be. And we realized soon after, I wouldn't go into the details, that this is not the way to go. And soon we started, we hadn't started our monetization journey on InShorts by then. We were overspending on our growth. We didn't have our retention funnels proportionately kind of made robust to handle that amount of growth budgets, right? So it was all wrong, simply
put. What was that tipping point?
I think the tipping point was when we realized we had burned through probably a sizable percentage of our Series B funding.
Mm.
And it was not going anywhere. It was not incrementally adding to proportionate amount of growth.
Yeah.
So I think that is when we realized that there is a fundamental cap of how much gas you need to push in your vehicle where, like, your vehicle will just crash, right?
Yeah.
So we understood this. So we both, I love driving, my co-founders love driving. So I think we use these analogies a lot, that there is, in every kind of automatic car as of today, there's this eco mode, and then there's a high speed mode, right? And then there's a neutral mode. So I think we understood that we were way beyond the high speed mode.
Mm-hmm.
And even if we wanted to grow fast, we had to at least come back to the high speed mode. And I think that tuned the company forever. And whatever decisions we took at that point of time, some were hard decisions, it tuned our company's DNA right to the bottom of the ladder, that this is how we'll operate. We'll look at economics, we'll look at rationality, we'll not overburn things, we'll be quick about our experiments, and we will monetize early. And that is the time we took the decision that we have a sizable audience, let's start our monetization engine, because it is not going to happen overnight.
Got it. Brilliant. I think that really clarifies it. Each company gets into this shape due to something or the other.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to know what led you there. But
probably like what's happened in the 2020, 21, 22 phase in India.
Yeah.
We had seen a teaser of that in 2016.
Yeah.
So we knew how to operate in this last couple of years.
Yeah. No, but that's very good to know. What's fascinating is, I know you cannot bracket what the formula looks like to build like a, you know, long-term institution, but if you had to like condense 2-3 very important factors which are almost like fundamental pillars of building a long-term company, what are they according to you?
I think one thing is having a very realistic understanding of the potential of revenue base that whatever business you are trying to build is going at. Like, you need to have a very strong kind of guesstimate of where you will be at, ballpark range, right? And then back calculate everything from that. Because I think what most early stage founders, because of obviously lack of experience and lack of that kind of intuitive ability, end up making a mistake on is always overestimating what scale they will end up at. Because what we have learned is whatever scale that you think this product will go at, you will hit a roadblock in distribution, in monetization, either in distribution or in monetization. Okay. So these are the two things that always end up underperforming than what you think they will perform at. At least the speed of it is always underperforming. And there is no way, there is no hacky ways to kind of solve it. These are fundamental value drivers that take hard work, hard iterations, like banging your head against the wall repeatedly to kind of make sure you have it right. And there's no way around it. So I think just thinking that you will throw a lot of money at solving these problems or a lot of people at solving these problems doesn't work at all. Your growth challenge or your monetization challenge cannot be a people problem and cannot be a money problem. It has to be a quality insight problem that can be leveraged.
Awesome. That's very fascinating to note. Another corollary to that is in terms of founder traits, right? If you had to blanket some very toothy, you know, qualities that you've seen yourselves grow into that really define the trajectory of the company or the team or the future of where you were leading, what would those be?
I think collectively we are realists. We would, although we are not a completely promoter-controlled company like Zerodha, but we would, I think we are very, very aligned to that school of thinking, that be very, very real. In fact, be pessimistically real, slightly pessimistically real, because it builds more robustness in the business. If you're optimizing for just gas valuation growth, then this is not the way to be. But if you are optimizing for outsized lifetime of your company that you're building or the brand that you're building, that it outlives everything, then that is the only way to build, right? So I don't think it was possible for a company like ours. When we started our journey, there was no concept of companies getting even angel checks who don't have revenue. It was not a concept that existed, right? In fact, one of our early evangelists who connected us to our angel investors, the problem that he was thinking, who is the person in the Indian angel ecosystem who will understand a product which has zero revenues? And that's how we shortlisted our potential angel investors. And I'm thankful that we got our angel investors to back us. But I think that's the problem. And I don't think we would have outlived these various phases of the Indian startup ecosystem had we not focused, optimized for survival and then valuation growth. I think people underrate survival, underestimate survival as a startup skill. And I think it's a very interesting time to have this conversation in because I don't think this would have vibed with anyone just last year, right? And in a year, you're back. Everyone. And this is the theme of the entire ecosystem, right?
No, that's a very, very important point. Both of them, realistic, almost positive pessimism to the extent of pessimism and that extent of survival. I completely agree with both those pointers. I think there's a very famous quote that if you stay relevant for long enough and you survive for long enough, you eventually win because others eventually end up dying. Right?
Absolutely. So absolutely.
I love that.
And I usually in the game of chess also, there are, even if you are a couple of points down, never underestimate the fact that your opponent might make a mistake that you can leverage.
Absolutely. That's awesome to know. If I had to add one there because of just like 150 odd conversations, I think this positive obsession that founders have around company building, around things that are happening around their company, right, is radiating energy that I just love because almost always, which can be good and bad, which is why I'm terming it positive, but they're always thinking about their companies, the next big move, what's happening, what can they do better. And that is just like very wonderful energy. But awesome. I think as we go to concluding aspects, Deepit, and we've covered a bunch of ground, I think I'd love to understand some very personal growth trajectories for you, because one of the attempts from the podcast is to really humanize the founder journey, right? Because it otherwise feels very distant and aspirational, almost like, you know, these distant figures which may or may not be possible. I want to understand the human side of it so that we can attempt to bridge that gap. One of the things there is, in shorts, as an entire company and now public, of course, you've now scaled to so much volume, so much growth. But in this decade, if you had to quantify your growth, that would be considerably difficult. But if I can qualitatively ask you what your scaling journey has been. So if you had to look back at that, you know, IIT Kharagpur grad who was going to take a gap year, convincing his parents to build out something. What was that like? And who are you like today? And what that delta looks like, I think that would be very fascinating to know.
Yeah, so this delta needs to be measured in logarithmic scale because it's exponential. I wouldn't say I was even 1/100th of a character that I am today. And I would say that aspirationally, I am not even 1/100th of the character I would want to be. So I think there were various points in our journey. I think every journey has these highs and lows in terms of founder relationships, in terms of managing expectations that you have of yourself at your workplace, right? Also having no real workplace experience as a founder, which was very unique to us, all three of us, and in challenges that that posed in front of each of us as a founder, and then how we make sure that we kind of balance all of this kind of, for a lack of a better word, khichdi, and then still make sure that one thing that we are as a unit of found, like the three founders, never going to do is compromise the survival of the company, right? I think that I'm actually, all three of us are really grateful to all three of us that we never let any ups and downs compromise that. That is the baseline, okay? That whatever, everything else, we can talk it out. We can talk it out for months. We can talk it out for years. But we, one thing that we'll never compromise on is that fundamental survival and robustness that we are trying to build in the company, right? And I think that alignment is very, very rare to have. I'm so grateful, and I'm sure my co-founders would also, they're not big public speakers that way, but I think all of us are really kind of, we are very emotional about it as well, and very passionate about telling this to other founders as well, that focus on the relationship fundamentals. Yeah. The earlier you focus on it, the less relationship mistakes you will make. The less relationships mistakes you make, the lesser it's going to end up costing your company because of that. And yeah, I think that is something that is something that was a very, very character building kind of a journey for us, because it takes immense amount of character, believe me, to be able to do this. And you know, the fundamental part is, if this unit of relationships are not strong, then the next unit of relationships are also not going to be strong enough, right? So I think fundamentally, how do you measure a strength of a relationship, right? You measure a strength of the relationship in terms of that when you are in the low phases of your relationship, do both parties have motivation enough to make an attempt to take it to the, turn it around again, right?
Yeah.
So I think overall the graph should keep going up irrespective of these multiple downturns and upturns that keep happening. So I think that has been one of the big personal growth journeys for me.
Awesome. Lovely to know that. It's amazing how you mention about character and relationships when it comes to growth. I think goes to show the importance of such traits when it comes to company building and just life in general, I suppose. Next up, I'd love to understand when it comes to more so just building, let's say, on a qualitative lens, in terms of just upskilling yourself, right? Because again, consumer internet businesses, absolutely, social, you have to be up and trendy with everything that's happening. And it's very interesting. Different founders have different ways. Some have these productivity hacks, some have these knowledge seeking ways to just grasp everything that's out there. What is your formula to make it happen?
Personally, like, I have become comfortable always playing catch up. I think initially I used to think that I would want to be in a state where I will not feel that I'm playing catch up. But I think fundamentally, you can't do that. You can't be in a state where you're not feeling that you are behind the curve, right? Yeah. Because fundamentally, innovation as an ecosystem will always outpace you as an individual, right? And you need to be constantly trying to understand what are those insights that other founders are building on, even if it is not working out, right? There might be like 10 insights that go into a product. Yeah. Maybe one of them paired with another gem of an insight from some other person together make something magical, right? You don't know. And that's the beauty of consumer internet, right?
Yeah.
So I really like, for me, the way to do it is like really talking to a lot of founders. I love talking to as many early stage founders as I love talking to late stage founders. So I think early stage founders should not be treated by founders like us as just someone to school. It should be a very, very equal conversation where you are also learning why that early stage founder feels conviction enough to go back this idea that hasn't proven itself, right? Yeah. So I think that is something that I tend to do. I love meeting early stage founders. The aggregate energy of everything that's happening is much larger than what I can do individually.
I can imagine. I love that. I think that phrase of being comfortable with playing catch up is a very interesting one. I think that's a deep thought which calls for a lot of introspection, but lovely that you mentioned it. I think for the second last bit, right, and this is interesting. This is very, I mean, simple in nature, but memories and stories form, you know, the crux of what we do eventually. So if you had to summarize maybe 2-3 significant milestones, memories, could be dark times as well, but just when you just stuck around to build what you have now, yeah. I think that'll be interesting to note.
No, absolutely. I think I remember this one memory of the three of us sitting in a park nearby, I think, one of our homes in Delhi. And in that small, like, DDA kind of park in Delhi, what we were doing was we were making our video for a YC application.
Okay.
And we still have that. And we see ourselves like 10 years ago and we are like, wow, we were writing a YC application in this way. Like, there's no way we would have gotten selected to YC, right? So I think that naive energy is still something that inspires us. Also, we've been lucky, right? In various ways that energy has gotten us somewhere. So being grateful for that, I think one memory we have that I think that keeps striking a chord with us. The other memory I think is very, very interesting, right? Like the first time we actually moved out from our individual kind of houses, so most of the team was living in this small Barsati. Okay, it was a two-room set. I had the privilege to be living with my parents because I was in that part of town. But all the others in the team were living in the two-room set. Aap ghar us do kamre ke darwaze se nikalte ho, and you see that it's just a balcony. And then on the right, there is a small kitchen. And on the left, there's a small toilet, right? That's where the InShots journey got built, right? So I think one should not lose that connect. That where we started from, and have that empathy for others who might be in a similar zone right now.
Awesome. I think that was lovely to hear. I think both the early naivety piece and the humble beginnings that you've had are so nice to note and so important to understand. I think as you know, we conclude, The last bit is this motivation that continues to keep entrepreneurs going is always something that's fascinated me. And I often ask founders, what keeps you going till date? Because from the outside, it looks like, you know, you've hit the milestones. There's considerable, debated, acknowledged success. What is the ongoing feel of still keeping you equally, you know, in charge, equally charged up to just go out there and keep fighting?
Absolutely. And I think in this, so I don't know whether I've stated in public domain earlier, but my co-founder Azhar, who's the CEO of the company, he comes from a very, very small town in Bihar called Kishanganj. Okay. And so like when we met for the first time in our 11th standard, when we were in the same coaching institute, we were coming from two very, very different worlds. I was coming from a slightly more city-ish culture, and he was coming from, so he had studied in boarding schools, local boarding schools, he had played truancy there, he had left boarding schools, he had run away, like very, very different worlds. And but there was this understanding of raw intelligence that we had for between each other, right? And that's how we also met our third co-founder, Anunay, right? So I think that raw I think it's a combination of hunger plus attitude, say learning attitude, plus intelligence, right? That makes the journey of, and constantly improving in that, that makes a founder kind of keep improving. And I think that improvement journey people can take irrespective of whether they're a founder or not, right? And I think if a person just dissociates from their identity as a founder and not overplay it in their heads, I think they will keep getting that energy. Because when we started out as founders, we wanted to be founders, but we were not successful founders. But we still wanted to do it, right? So the motivation, the source of motivation is not coming from the fact that we are founders. Mm-hmm. The source of the motivation is coming from who we are as people. And has that gas run out? No, for all of us. So I think that's something that we need to look at. If we overstate our identities as founders and not as people, I think you can either develop a strong sense of ego, or you can develop a strong sense of entitlement, or you might feel that, oh, we are building it for 10 years, I'm tired.
Yeah.
Don't overstate it. Like, right? Just focus on what you are as people and then go take it from there.
That's amazing, Deepak. I think, again, very, very deep thought there. And just knowing that you can't be associated to the title or the aspiration as much. You have to be associated to what fundamentally drives you, who you are as people, and let that run its course. Lovely. I think this has been so wonderful, Deepit. For the concluding question, right, I want to go back to the original theme of the podcast and maybe summarize it for aspiring founders from your words. If somebody is looking to build social or in consumer internet in India, what are 2-3 very important exclusions that you can perhaps suggest, as we were just discussing, right? Sometimes the negating factors are more extrapolated amongst journeys than the positive ones. So if you can maybe blanket this out for us as we conclude, that would be a lovely end.
Definitely. So I think 2 exclusions. Don't shy away from building non-social platforms is okay. One thing. Like, people over-optimize on social elements in platforms. Social elements play a key role in building platforms, but don't shy away from leveraging how platforms itself can add a lot of value, differentiated value on the internet, just by virtue of being platforms. Like, for example, YouTube has so much social elements, but fundamentally, the large part of the value that YouTube creates for its audience is by virtue of being a platform in itself, right? So I think people over-index on social, and everybody has a different perception of social. But fundamentally what it is that there are platform network effects that start kicking in, And that network effects can be leveraged, harnessed while building social. I think so. That is one key kind of directional, very, I think it's slightly vague, but I think it captures the fact that don't think social first and platform later. Think of platform first and social later. Because that will give you a more in-depth understanding of what the consumer is coming to you for. And the second very, very, I think, interesting thing that has been driving me or kind of rooting me every time is fundamentally understanding why a customer would talk about your product more, why a customer would be evangelical about your product. That is a very, very subjective thing. It doesn't get captured in data. It has to be derived or interpreted. So it's completely about your interpretation, about why the customer is using you and why do some customers become evangelical about your products and some others don't, even though they might be larger consumers in like LTV value or CAC, whatever, like LTV to CAC ratio. All those numbers will say that this user is better. Right. But there might be some another user who's half as good for you in terms of the value generated, in terms of ad revenue or whatever, but much stronger in terms of evangelical value.
Yeah. Awesome. Those are very interesting learnings. Very fascinated by that. I want to end, but I usually don't ask very future-looking questions because I feel they become very subjective after a point. But since we have you here and your vantage point is interesting, before we end, can you maybe help us understand what are themes in consumer internet for India or social for India that excite you the most? Because we're also at a cusp of looking at other platforms which are stagnating in nature. We saw, you know, the audio rise that happened and still continues to happen in India and globally. Facebook is stagnating, they say, whatnot, right? What are themes that excite you? I don't like these questions, but we have you on, so maybe I'd love to know.
Yeah, fundamentally, I think the biggest theme, the biggest platform of the next wave of innovation is going to be, definitely it's going to be AI. It's not going to be Web3. It's not going to be AR, especially in India. Mm-hmm. So I think AI is the most biggest, single, strongest platform mm-hmm. on which the next waves of innovation will happen. And I think people have woken up to AI because of GPT-3 and ChatGPT and whatever. But a large part of the AI innovation happened before that. Like, for example, simple object recognition has become so sharp in images, and that predates ChatGPT, right? Yeah. So I think being laser focused on how you can use AI as a platform, you don't need to be a data scientist for it. How you can use AI as a platform to innovate further. And I'm not talking about simple use cases like which are just wrappers around ChatGPT solutions, right? Mm-hmm. Those are the buzzwords now, but I think we need to have a more macro view about AI and how it's evolving and how you can leverage that going forward.
Absolutely. Awesome. AI is the way, and with everything happening around the world, there's only room for more. Thank you so much, Deepit, for being on the show. It's been such a pleasure to hear from the creator, the one of the creators of InShorts, Public, and so much of what's happening. We've covered so much ground in terms of, when I look back, I think it doesn't feel like just 60, 70 odd minutes. It feels like covering the journey, understanding consumer social in India, and a bunch of other things. Thank you so much, and I hope you had a lovely time.
Yes, it was a very, very insightful conversation. And for lack of a better concluding statement, I think in some types of stuff, long form content works better.
Absolutely. Lovely to know that. Thank you so much again for being on the show.
Thank you.